The Hidden History of Britain, Part 4. The Irish Druids. The word magi, the Latin equivalent for druids, was used by early Irish writers and frequently by the Welsh. Their synonymity in the modern mind appears to be almost entirely lost. The term magi conjures up a sacred meaning indicative of the exact opposite to that which we have been led to believe about the Druids. The Druids were, in Celtic hagiology, constantly termed magi. It is quite possible that the magi of the New Testament fame, who departed into their own country another way, in Matthew chapter 2 verse 12, visited Britain on their return journey to the East. Tradition always bears a vein of truth, however fantastic therein lies buried fact, and Irish historians have reiterated all along the centuries that Conor Mac Nessa, the King of Ulster, who died AD 48, was made aware by his chief druid Bacrach of the happenings in Palestine at the time of the crucifixion. This king requiring of his druid an explanation of the darkness that was over all the earth, as mentioned in Luke chapter 23, verse 44. It is not improbable that the druid had his information and enlightenment as to the fulfilment of prophecy from the visiting druids or magi from the east. It would be perfectly natural on the part of these magi to visit Britain, the headquarters of Druidism. James Heron, D.D., mentions a sacred caste in Ireland called the Druida or Magi. John Toland relates that in Ireland, as in England, the Druids were exempt from bearing arms, yet the decisions were final in matters concerning both peace and war. Some of them were allied to kings, many of them were the king's own sons, and great numbers were drawn from the aristocracy. They wore long habits, as did the bards and ovates, but the druids wore white surplices when they officiated in religious ceremonies. They, with the bards and the ovates, had the privilege of wearing six colours in their brechans or robes, the king and queen, seven, lords and ladies, five, governors of fortresses, four, officers and young gentlemen, three, soldiers, two, and common people, one. This law, most of the Irish historians say, was enacted under Aeacus or Iochaid Olam Fodla the First, a king of the Irish in 1383 BC. This king also ordained that every noble person should have a coat of arms assigned to him to distinguish him in battle and to rally his followers, hence the crest. This cognizance was often appended to a man's name and became his surname. The bards were divided into three orders or degrees, namely chronologers, heralds, and poets. The first registered genealogies, the second sang the praises of great men, and the third, including inferior rhymers, lived most of the year free of cost. In a great national assembly at Drumkeet in the County Derry under Aedas Amareus, the 11th Christian king, in the year 575 AD, where were present Aedas, king of Scotland, and St. Columba, it was decreed that for the better preservation of their history, genealogies, and the purity of their language, the supreme monarch and the subordinate kings, with every lord of a cantred or hundred, should entertain a poet of his own, no more being allowed by the ancient law of the island, and that upon these and their posterity a portion of land should be settled for ever. At the assembly, St. Columba pleaded for the independence of Scottish Dalriada from Irish suzerainty and for toleration for the Irish bards who had been banished by the king for their exactions and turbulence. The inferior rhymers lived by travelling from place to place and by entertaining the people by satire and song. It was also decreed that for the encouragement of poets and antiquaries, public schools should be appointed under the national inspection, and that the monarch's own bard should be arch-poet and have superintendence over the rest. With regard to public schools in Ireland, the Brehon laws had distinct rules for the relation between pupil and teacher. The Brehon, with his pupils, constituted not a school in our sense of the term, but a true family. Ireland produced scholars of note. Fergil, known on the continent as Virgilius the Geometer, affirmed the rotundity of the earth. Sir Julius, 8th century, wrote on grammar, on government, and on theology. Clement, an Irishman, was employed by Charlemagne, along with Alcuin and Dicuil, the author of a geography, Liber de Mensura Terrae, who was also Irish. Writing in 1720, John Toland states, quote, "The Irish have incomparably more ancient material for their history than either the English or the French, or any other European nation with whose manuscripts I have any acquaintance. In all conditions, the Irish have been strangely solicitous, if not in some degree superstitious, about preserving their books and parchments, even those of them which were so as to be now partly unintelligible. Abundance, through overcare, have perished underground, the concealer not having the skill for preserving them." Close quote. The most valuable pieces, both in verse and prose, were written by the Druids. Some were interpolated after the prevailing of Christianity, which additions or alterations are, nevertheless, easily distinguishable. In these books were the rites and formularies of the Druids, together with their divinity and philosophy, and their two grand doctrines of the eternity and the incorruptibility of the universe. Their laws were termed celestial judgments, and were only preserved in traditionary poems, according to the institution of the Druids, until committed to writing at the command of Conor MacNessa, King of Ulster, AD 48. The three greatest encouragers of learning among the early Irish monarchy were King Achaeus, 1383 BC, surnamed the Doctor of Ireland, who is said to have built at Lothair Crofin, Tara, an academy called the Court of the Learned. It was he who ordained for every principal family hereditary antiquaries, or in case of incapacity, the most able of the same historical house, with ranks and privileges after the Druids. The next promoter of letters was King Tuathalus, 1st century AD, who appointed a triennial revision of all the antiquaries' books by a committee of three kings or great lords, three Druids and three antiquaries. These were to cause whatever was approved and found valuable in these books to be transcribed in the Royal Book of Tara. The third patron of literature was King Cormac, AD 266, who renewed the laws about the antiquaries and rebuilt and enlarged the Academy of Tara for history, law, and military training. He was an indefatigable distributor of justice, having written numerous laws still extant. After the introduction of Christianity, the Druid, where he accepted the new religion, became bishop or priest, but great numbers remained on the same footing, insomuch that for a long time after the English conquest, the judges, bards, physicians, and harpers held such tenures in Ireland. The O'Devegans were hereditary bards, the O'Clerys and the O'Brodins were hereditary antiquaries, the O'Shields and the O'Canvans were hereditary doctors, the McGlanchys were hereditary judges. The Druids did not at all times receive fair treatment from the Christians. Dudley Forbes, in a letter to an Irish writer, states that in St. Patrick's time, no fewer than 130 volumes relating to the affairs of the Druids were burnt in Ireland. What a deplorable extinction of arts and inventions, What an unspeakable detriment to learning. What a dishonour upon human understanding has the cowardly proceeding of the ignorant, or rather the interested, at all times occasioned. Moore, the poet, when undertaking to write the history of Ireland, spoke slightingly of the value to the historian of Ireland of the material afforded by national manuscripts. In the year 1839, Moore, in company with Dr. Petrie, visited the Royal Irish Academy and was shown a number of ancient books useful for historical research and reference. Moore, on briefly scanning these books, turned to Dr. Petrie and said, quote, "Petrie, these huge tomes could not have been written by fools or for any foolish purpose. I never knew anything from them before, and I had no right to have undertaken the history of Ireland." Close quote. And from that day, Moore, it is said, lost all heart for going on with his history of Ireland, and it was only the importunity of the publishers which induced him to bring out the remaining volume. The Bards survived the merging of Druidism into Christianity for centuries and enjoyed their ancient honours and privileges in many places down to the reign of Queen Elizabeth. Until 1746, the Bards of Munster continued to hold their half-yearly sessions in the county of Limerick. As with Bards, the judges survived the fall of the druidical system. They had four successors and representatives, those who in English are called Brechon, from the Celtic word Brethon, which means judge. Cusack says that the whole system of government and legislation was patriarchal, indicative of an Eastern origin, and that in the Brechon laws, said to be the oldest code of laws in Europe, there are evidences which look very like a trace of Judean tradition. Another writer affirms that the Brechon Code, in parts, is a republication of the Mosaic Law, which declared that the firstborn of every creature, including the firstborn of man, was to be presented to the Lord. In this connection, it is interesting to note that the Welsh call the Irish a Dhu, and the country a Dhuan, or Dhuesland. Camden gives a quotation from Postelius' lecture on Pomponius Mela, a first-century writer. "Ireland was then called Durin, quasi Jewsland, because in the distant past the Jews, Israel, who were great soothsayers, knew that the future empire of the world would come to these parts." The Psalter of Cashel says that Tuatha De Danann ruled in Ireland for about two centuries and were highly skilled in architecture and other arts from their long residence in Greece. Sir Henry Maine observed, "We who are able here to examine coolly the ancient Irish law in an authentic form, see that it is a very remarkable body of archaic law, unusually pure from its origin. As in Britain, so in Ireland, human bones which had been fractured and reset have been found in Druidic tumuli." When Nueda, an early Irish king, lost his hand in battle, Creidne, an artificer, put a silver hand upon him, the fingers of which were capable of motion. Moreover, besides possessing ships and armies and working in the metals, the Irish had an organised body of surgeons, whose duty it was to attend upon the wounded in battle. These were drawn from the Druidic class, who preserved the history of the country and the deeds of kings and heroes.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
The Romans and the Druids. The first decree against the Druids was enacted by the Emperor Tiberius under the plausible pretext of punishing them for offering human sacrifice, a decree as cruel as the pretext was false. The real reason was to destroy their influence in the state, an influence which extended through all the tribes. When the Romans, observed Cleland, effected a footing in Britain, they found in Druidism a constant and implacable enemy to their usurpation. They would have been glad to introduce their own religion, But to that point, there was an invincible obstacle in the horror and contempt of the natives, for a religion formed their own allegories, which made the name of the Roman gods as familiar to them as Julius Caesar states, but in a sense which excluded them from reception in a divine one. The report on the Druids, as given by Suetonius Claudius and passed on to other Roman historians, accusing them of arranging for frightful holocausts of victims in wicker cages, has nothing but the assertion of this hostile Roman general to support it. The same historians also accuse the early Christians of abominable practices. The Romans did indeed themselves, on many occasions, burn the houses of the Britons, which were, in the case of the poorer inhabitants, made of wickerwork covered with clay. Bishop Brown describes the work of an antiquarian who dug up one of these dome-shaped hillocks and found the remains of the old British houses of wickerwork, the impress of the wicker remaining on the burnt clay, as indelible as the writing upon Assyrian monuments. The Roman story is a palpable invention to cover their own inhumane methods of warfare. The Druidic religion, like the Christian religion, was diametrically opposed to all other religious practices in the world. Druidism and Christianity were both marked for destruction by the Romans. Athenagoras, in AD 176, in his work entitled An Embassy, concerning the Christians, carefully describes and indignantly repudiates the three charges of atheism, cannibalism, and lust, which were commonly urged against Christians in connection with their Eucharists, and pleads for an impartial trial that would lead to a just verdict. In the case of Christianity, all efforts to bring it into opprobrium and to annihilation were overcome. It lived to vindicate its quality and to cover the world with its beneficent institutions and influence. With Druidism, the case was different, as at the very beginning of the Christian era, it quickly dissolved as a separate organisation. Druidism eagerly accepted a fuller revelation and became merged into Christianity. The immediate need, therefore, was not the defence of the principle and practice of the Druidic religion, but knowledge of a faith of which, hitherto, very little had been perpetuated into writing. Consequently, real knowledge of its nature decayed. An ignorant or malevolent representation, false in their beginnings, continue, pitifully, to be accepted without investigation, as if they had come from the very source of truth. In AD 61, Suetonius Paulinus, the legate in Britain, proceeded to carry out instructions received from Rome to extirpate Druidism at any cost. The Roman army, including the 9th Legion from Lincoln, may be pictured moving along Watling Street through Chester, where they were joined by the auxiliary and other auxiliary forces on their way to Anglesey, where great numbers of Druid priests had taken refuge. The corporation of the 2nd Augusta, stationed at Caerleon-on-Usk, was refused by the prefectus from motives of jealousy. Tacitus, patently unsympathetic with the gallant defenders of Britain, graphically describes the massacre of the priests which took place on that occasion. The Anglesey massacre had terrified the consciences of its perpetrators, as it had roused to fury the passions of the whole population. The war, from that moment, became a religious war. Suetonius was recalled. Tacitus assigns as the cause the revolt of all Britain. The 9th Legion was completely broken at Anglesey, and it afterwards received its full complement of men from Germany. The powerful resistance offered by the native tribes to the Roman invasions was mainly due to the exalted doctrine of the indestructibility of the soul taught by their religion. Among the Celtic nations, the persons of the Druid was always held sacred and inviolable. This was even the case with respect to the bard, who is captured while encouraging his warriors in the midst of tribal conflict. the bards, whilst abhorring war themselves and ever striving for peace, accompanied their tribal or clan fighting men when conflict became inevitable, urging them on with words and songs of encouragement. The Romans, however, did not recognise the rule of inviolability. When they found the bard in the ranks of the enemy, they consigned him to a worse fate than that of the rest of the captives. Destruction of the Druids and Bards seemed, to the Romans, the shortest road to the conquest of Britain, and they were attracted to its shores by the stories of its wealth, its pearls, its tin, its gold, all appealing to the Roman love for gain. The Romans were not, however, prepared for the loyalty of the people to the Druidical religion and government, which they had held dear for many centuries, nor for the fearlessness of the Britons in the face of an implacable enemy. Bravely they fought in fair trappings, with their cloaks of plaid and their torques of gold, with necklaces of amber and shields of shining bronze, well embossed and enamelled. No sacrifice was too great in defence of their birthright. The cumulative evidence of history is that Druidism and Christianity had no greater enemy than Imperial Rome. In striking contrast to Roman intolerance, there is one feature of the religion of the ancient Britons spoken of with admiration by all writers: its freedom from intolerance. Druidism knew of no such violation of others' rights as persecution. There is no record of any missionary to Britain having suffered martyrdom under Druidism. It has been well said that among the Druids there were numerous confessors of Christianity, but there were no martyrs. The paganism of civilized Rome had its thousands of victims among the early Christians. The paganism, so-called, of Britain had none. And it could be well if the same could be said of some of the forms of Christianity which followed.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Druidic survivals. Megalithic remains in Britain are generally uninscribed, and it is a remarkable circumstance that while statues of gods and goddesses prevail throughout the heathen sites of Egyptian, Greek, Roman, and other idolatrous nations, no identifiable idol or image has ever been found in Britain of the pre-Roman period. The gigantic monoliths placed in circles and the piles of stones were alike unhewn. These piles, called scions or cairns, and in the north of England known as laws or lows, were usually placed on the summit of hills and mounds, and so disposed as to lie in sight of one of the other cairns of the system. Many places in the British Isles are denominated from these cairns or lows. The similarity of Sion with the Hebrew word Zion, fortress, the mount of stone, as the name Zion in Celtic means, is striking. On May Eve, and on the first day of November, the Druids caused prodigious fires to be made on these scions or cairns, which afforded a wonderful illumination over much of the country. Those on May Eve were to obtain a blessing on the fruits of the earth, that they might be abundant. Those on the first of November were a thanksgiving at the finish of the harvest. There are survivals in many parts of the Scottish Highlands of Druidic religious custom, places where the dead are first born sunwise in their progress towards the place of the sepulchre. A boat going to sea must first go sunwise. A man or woman immediately after marriage must take a turn sunwise. Everything that is to move prosperously must, among many of the Celts, first move sunwise. Some of our great fairs may be traced to their origin in the days when our forefathers assembled on the fair field close to the circle on the three great festivals of the year. The name Mayfair in London is a survival from Druidic times, and it is the name of the place where, down to the Middle Ages, great fairs were held. A large portion of land near Stonehenge is still called the Fair Field. Close to many of the druidic circles, were places of assembly called maidans, now maiden, and in most of the places where assembly and free speech are allowed today, the custom and right of the people may be traced back to druidic times. Attached to the druidic circle was the sanctuary or place of refuge. When the London city circle became merged in the Christian church of St. Martin le Grand, where the general post office now stands, privilege of sanctuary survived there until the reign of James I, and to this day, the space fronting the west door of Westminster Abbey is known as Broad Sanctuary. The Beltane, or spring festival of Druidism, became our Easter. The summer solstice, or Whitsuntide, became our Whitsuntide, and the midwinter festival, when the mistletoe was gathered with gold sickles, became our Christmas. So favourably impressed were some of our early reformers with the principles of Druidism that they embodied certain Druidic laws and ideas in their new codes. For instance, it is to St. Swithin, the first Chancellor Bishop, that the Church owes the restoration by statute of the Druidic law of tithes. The Druidic triads are a heritage that should be valued for their simple beauty and the noble thoughts to which they give expression. Matthew Arnold says, quote, "What a feeling for style in composition is manifested in the famous Welsh triads. We may put aside the vexed question as to their greater or lesser antiquity, and still what important witness they bear to the genius for literary style of the people who produced them." Close quote. According to Max Müller, these triads are the oldest literature in the oldest living language in Europe. And he writes, quote, "If the study of Celtic languages and Celtic antiquities deserves to be encouraged anywhere, it is surely in England. In order to supply sound material and guiding principles to the critical student of the ancient history and ancient language of Britain, to excite an interest in what still remains of Celtic antiquities, whether in manuscript or in genuine stone monuments, and thus to preserve such national heirlooms from neglect or utter destruction." Close quote. A note to Lord Lytton's King Arthur states, quote, "The triads indeed are of various dates, but some bear the mark of a very remote antiquity, wholly distinct alike from the philosophy of the Romans and the mode of thought prevalent in the earlier ages of the Christian era, in short, anterior to all the recorded conquests of the Cumrian people. These, like proverbs, appear the wrecks and fragments of some primeval ethics or philosophical religion, nor are such remarkable alone for the purity of the notions they inculcate relative to the deity. They have often, upon matters less spiritual, the delicate observation, as well as the profound thought, of reflective wisdom. Nor were the Druids of Britain inferior to those with whom the sages of the Western and Eastern worlds came into contact. On the contrary, even to the time of Caesar, the Druids of Britain excelled in science and repute those of Gaul, and to their schools the neophytes were sent." Close quote. On the same theme, Dudley Wright states, "It is established by the most unquestionable authority that the Celts were the original inhabitants of Europe, that the Celtic language was a dialect of the primary language of Asia, and that the Celtae had among them, from the remote antiquity, an order of literati called Druids, to whom the Greeks and Romans ascribed a degree of philosophic celebrity inferior to none of the sages of the past." Close quote. The spiritual character of druidical teaching is illustrated in the following triads. The three foundations of Druidism: peace, love, justice. The three things God alone can do: endure the eternities of infinity, participate of all being without changing, renew everything without annihilating it. There are three primeval unities, and more than one of each cannot exist. One God, one truth, and one point of liberty where all opposites preponderate. Three things proceed from the three primeval unities, all of life, all that is good, and all that is power. The three primary principles of wisdom: wisdom to the laws of God, concern for the welfare of mankind, suffering with fortitude all the accidents of life. The three primary ornaments of wisdom are love, truth, and courage. Three things that make a man equal to an angel: the love of everything good, the love of exercising charity, the love of pleasing God. There are three men that all ought to look on with affection: he that with affection looks on the face of the earth, he that is delighted with rational works of art, and he that looks lovingly on little infants. Three duties of every man: worship God, be just to all men, die for your country. One of the leading maxims of the Druids was to examine without prejudice all matters that came under their observation. The Druidical teaching concerning a man's spiritual nature is comprised in the following triad. In every person there is a soul, in every soul there is intelligence, in every intelligence there is thought, in every thought there is either good or evil, in every evil there is death, in every good there is life, and in every life there is God. Much nonsense is spoken, and by many believed, concerning the dragon, the emblem of Wales. Many give it a religious significance, connecting it in some way with the devil. Others, with the monster with which St. George had dispute. It has no connection with either. In the ancient British language, dragon was the name given to a leader in war. The prefix pen or head was introduced to indicate the chief leader, and as the premier tribe or people of Britain, the Welsh continue to display the flag on which is depicted the dragon. The Welsh also hold the oldest religious emblem in these islands. This emblem, the leek, is as ancient as the Druidic order itself, and is symbolic of the circles at which the inhabitants foregathered for worship. The leek continues to be depicted on the badge of the Druidic order of Wales. Perhaps in the three feathers, borne in the crest of the Prince of Wales, and in the government mark known as the broad arrow, we possess the most notable of any, and the most universally known, though not generally recognised, survival from Druidic times. It is not so well known, however, that the three feathers and the broad arrow had their origin in the Druidic symbol for the ineffable name of the deity, three rays of light. Every Druid priest bore these in gold on the front of his tiara, and a coin in the British Museum inscribed Cunobelin, 14 BC, representing a horse galloping to the left, displays as an accessory symbol a diadem with a plume of ostrich feathers. Edward III adopted the symbol, the sign of spiritual and temporal power of the ancient Celtic kings and priests, as a cognizance of his son, the Black Prince. In the form of three ostrich feathers, the three golden rays have been borne from that time by the successive princes of Wales. We find the broad arrow cut by the ordnance surveyors as a level mark, alike upon solitary mountain peak and curbstone of crowded alley, the sacred symbol that proclaims from long ago and from generation to generation the national faith in the protecting power of the Almighty. The motto of the Druids, the truth against the world, survives to the present day as the motto of the Druidic Order of Wales. The revived Druidic Gorsedd of Wales, held each year as the national Eisteddfod, presents a picture of those vast assemblies at which the ancient Britons foregathered in the practice of their religion. The circle is formed of 12 unhewn stones. In the centre is the Manchog, or Logan stone, symbolic of the house of God. 12 bards, one by each stone, guard the circle today as in times past, and two keepers of the gate are stationed at the entrance on the eastern side. The magnificent regalia of the order is borne in the procession before the Archdruid, in which is included the sword surmounted by its crystal and an emblematic dove. Also, the Hurlass horn, symbolic of authority, the drinking vessel of the ancient druids and used by them for sacred purposes. It is possible that our custom of drinking healths may be traced to this ancient druidic ritual. The ceremonial invocation, said to be as old as the druidic order, is, in the Welsh language, very impressive. Perhaps it suffers somewhat in the following English translation. Grant, O God, thy protection, and in protection strength, and in strength understanding, and in understanding knowledge, and in knowledge the knowledge of justice, and in the knowledge of justice the love of it, and in that love the love of all existence, and in the love of all existence the love of God, God and all goodness. At the moment of prayer, all the bards bow the head towards the Manchlog, or centre stone. In the survival of this simple ceremony is presented a picture of the solemn assemblies of our forefathers and a very inspiring link with the past. Within the stones of Federation there, on the green turf and under the blue sky, a noble band of the bards of Britain stood, their heads in reverence bowed and bare of foot, a deathless brotherhood. By Southey Madoc.